I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, everyone. Hope you can hear me. A very warm welcome on a cold night to the London Review Bookshop, where I am absolutely delighted to welcome Zadie Smith and Adam Thirlwell to talk about their new books, respectively, The Fraud and The Future Future. We've had both authors in before. We've done events with both before separately, and it's just a real joy to have two people in together talking about their work. It feels exciting. It's gonna feel good, and that's why you're all here. That's it from me, and just help me welcome our guests. Thank you both so much. Cheers.
Thank you.
Hi.
So I think the reason why we're here is because we've known each other for, before I was even first published.
Mm-hmm. 20-something years.
20 years ago. And a couple of years ago, a year ago, I'd sent the manuscript of The Future Future to Zadie to read. And she'd written back saying it's really weird because I'm just finishing my new novel and there are many parallels. However different they are, there are many parallels between the two. So what we thought would be kind of interesting, hopefully, would be to sort of think about these parallels,
yep,
and maybe think about why...
We made some notes.
Why they are.
Out of anxiety.
We've made anxious notes, which are words.
Yes.
And so the first thing, I think we're both feeling quite old.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's fair.
And old-fashioned. And I think the thing that links these two, especially, or kind of at the beginning, is this idea of, I think we're both passionate defenders of the novel as a form and the novelistic as a way of writing and maybe even a way of reading. And at the same time, both these books seem to hate writers with a feral passion. So I guess the first question, is like, yeah, what does the novel, like, why are you so attached to that way of writing, as it were? Why do we not just write essays?
God, that's a good one. I think for both of us, the act of translation is important. There's a line somewhere in, I remember it being here in the book, in your book, about translation, not to insist on being a single thing. And right after it, there's some sentence about everybody was very hung up on description. So we've both long had this like anxiety about everyone being hung up on description, and yet it's literally our job to sit around describing things day in, day out. That tension has been there from the beginning, like a love of language, a fascination with it, but a suspicion about it, about how far it reaches and what
it
can do.
Good enough that it doesn't do the job.
Well, we were talking downstairs before we got up here about being 90s kids and being trained on Saussure, which is what they used to drill into your head, this kind of linguistic theory, which was that the word for something is much larger than the thing it signs for, basically, and that language just escapes whatever you try to contain it in. And that's something that's beautiful about the novel and that I enjoy. But it also is dangerous for the world, because we're constantly thinking that we can describe everything in the world through language. But both these novels are interested in things which escape language, that can't be known by language, that can't be colonised by language.
Yeah, and I think that's one effect. I think that's something that's changed for me, because I think when I was 25, I think I...
Yeah, you really thought you could do it. Thought if you just had enough
that it was
smarts,
all going to be fine.
You could cover the world in language, describe it, everything, put everything to rights.
Yeah, and I think this definitely reflects, I think, in both ways, I think, a kind of sense of the limits of what you can do, maybe just not only with the sentence, I think, but with the whole form of a novel, like with the kind of canvas of a novel or the breadth of a novel.
Right.
I mean, I guess the thing that, like, the word I think I was taught at college, as it were, was irony. So we were taught that, like, and I think that's still what I deep down believe, is that a novel is structured on some kind of system of ironies, so that no one is right. That's the basic kind of...
Right.
Everyone thinks they're right, and that the good novel will construct a kind of complex network where everyone somehow, like, something contradicts something somewhere else.
Yes.
And they're, I don't know, like, what they want is never matched up with what they get, or the consequence is always an unintended consequence.
I really did believe in that as a kind of morality of a novel when I was young, and that process of reading in that ironical way, of understanding that nobody has to complete ownership of truth, was somehow improving. That would improve you, that would make you move through the world in a different way. But the historical novels we've read, I mean, the novels from that period, particularly the Victorian novels in my case, that are so beautifully written, so alluring, such a beautiful whole, do all of that, you know, complicated moral business. And people read them, enjoyed them, and did nothing. That's been a central problem for us as well from the beginning. The knowledge that, you know, Nazi guards listened to Bach and read Tolstoy, and that this supposed humanizing process of the novel doesn't always function in that way. It doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't make good people at the other end.
Or is that just not the thing that if it is working, that's not the proof that it's working? So maybe we were wrong to be thinking, well, they should have some massive improving, that society would be much better because we've written novels.
Yeah, we're definitely wrong about that. that was a massive error.
That was a massive original error. But maybe there is this, it might be more momentary than that. So it might be that for the space, like, because I think that one of the things in the contemporary moment that clearly I think we're both worried about is that kind of reading, because it's not just, I think, you know, you try and construct this thing, but then you construct the thing you'd like to read.
Yeah, I'm still attached to that idea of reading. That's the thing. Even if I don't believe it is a kind of simple machine that ends in a certain result, I still... I'm attached to the idea that the signifier is excessive, that it goes all over the place, that it doesn't belong completely to a person, that you cannot define someone entirely by saying white man, black man, tall woman, big house, that something about language escapes its supposed signification. And that is important to me. That's like a kind of freedom that I need. I want to go to my list.
Do you think...
Sorry, go on.
I'm just thinking... There's a line in an essay by Kundera when he's talking about one of Tolstoy's novels, and he has this beautiful sentence where he says, the truth is that all great novels are more intelligent than the novelist who wrote it.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something to do with what we're talking about with the construction, that if there's something that happens in whatever we're calling a true novel, as opposed to the bad novels, and the thing that, the difference, the kind of moment, is this moment of liberation where somehow the novel gets free.
It goes so far beyond you. Has its own logic, partly because, and that's the other thing that I hold on to from the 90s that isn't very fashionable, is that the language that I use is in no way mine. It doesn't belong to me. It's not issuing from me as like some... It's a tissue of a culture. It comes from all kinds of places. Yeah. All I do is move it around, put it into place, but it's not... I don't own it in that sense. And that explains that feeling, which is so persistent when you finish a novel, that the novel is smarter than you, better than you, organised differently than you, thinks in a different way than you do, because novels have their own logic after a while.
And I think often are more ethical than you.
Far more. The gap between the goodness of a novel and the goodness of me is, like, huge. I want to talk a little bit about why a historical novel, because for two writers who were so committed to the contemporary... I think it was like it was a kind of nightmare, the idea that I would write a historical novel.
I think you're kind of ashamed.
Yes, I think I was a little bit ashamed. If what a historical novel meant was nostalgia, a conservative idea of the past, or willing to return to the past, but the moment I read your book, first of all, I was jealous of how fully you committed to the strategy, because part of the strategy to me was to catch them undefended. That's always the strategy of a novel. You have to get around people's, maybe in a neurological way, the neural pathways they've got used to. You have to find some way to, like, short-circuit it, go around the sides, make them think things they wouldn't normally think. And suddenly the most obvious way to do that was to go to the place that everybody has decided is completely uninteresting. Yesterday. Yesterday is so over. Everything that happened in the past is of no use to us. There's nothing there that we need. So it was a kind of... Yeah. A useful place to be. But then the problem was, what about the language? Because I'm goddamned if I'm writing a 19th century novel in 19th century language. So when I started reading yours, it's so, if you haven't read Adams, it's got this brilliant technique of realizing that given that everybody is French anyway and that we are thinking and working in translation, that translation might as well be completely contemporary. So messages being sent across Paris, you know, at great speed are just messages, and to our ear immediately sound like emails or WhatsApp or all the languages kind of both in the present and the past simultaneously. And I was so enlivened by it, whereas my strategy was just to try and reduce all the decoration of Victorian language until it was as close to my own voice as possible without, you know, lurching into anachronism. But your anachronisms, that's the point. You're like... You're right. You're in two places simultaneously.
Well, I think I was so worried by people pointing out anachronisms.
But you're like, fuck it, I'm going to have nothing but.
Oh, just nothing but. They can't. But I think it was also part of that, yeah, this idea of I'm not really wanting to write a novel literally about the past. It's a contemporary novel that will somehow have this 18th century right. setting.
And well, I think, that's what Devorah, who I can see there, who's a great reader of both of us, she's ignoring me, said early on, is that it's not a historical novel, it's an intervention. It's a way of thinking about the past with your present mind on.
Yeah.
And that, the moment she said that, I felt really freed by the idea, just as if I were writing an essay about the past, but in fictional form, you know?
Do you think also, because it's interesting, you chose the Victorian era, I chose the 18th century, and I think we've discussed this before, of like there's some way in which both of us, in many ways, like for me, if I, you know, the 18th, something about 18th century literature I've always loved. And I think right. for you, it was 19th century literature in one
sense. But like, I think that relates to the two key questions of our career, which yours was, they're to do with communality. What is a scene, is Adam's question. What is a scene? Like, what is a scene? What is a scene? Is it a, there's a line in the book somewhere it says, I walked into a party looking for an ally. And I think for our generation, you were trying to find what people would call now chosen family or some other way of organising your communal life. So Adam's question was always, what is a scene?
What's your question?
My question, I think, is what is a people? Which yeah. was a previous question for Jewish writers like a generation before. But by the time I came up, I was in that position of the Jewish writer of the 50s and 60s. Like, yeah. what is a people? What does this term mean? If I'm a member of the African diaspora, if I'm a black person, what does it mean to be a people? What are the kind of limits and borders of it? So it doesn't really surprise me that the novels work in that way. The 18th century is a scene and a cool scene. And the 19th century is not cool in any way, but is entirely about peoples, like these battles between peoples, between worlds, England, Jamaica, colonial world, the centre. And also, I guess, for both of us, the idea of the periphery. Because you're from the suburbs and I'm from whatever you call Willesden, urban suburb, but definitely not in the centre. Always
yeah.
like looking
and I think
in.
A constant yearning for what
a yearning
was cool.
for whatever the fuck was going on somewhere else in the centre. So when I was reading a book, that's what I saw. It was like another interrogation of the scene, but also like this is where middle age comes in with a slight melancholy. Because I think you run into a party at 23. Really looking for an ally and believing it's possible. At 45, maybe...
You're just trying to leave.
You're less convinced that allies are going to happen at this party. And maybe also just the flow of ideas about these things, scenes and people, have changed underneath us. So, I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about the longer you stay in the world, you realise that even what seem very firm ideas are in the culture... are rhetorical strategies that can flip literally 180 degrees within 20 years and keep on doing so.
Yeah, for the just said too much. If we go, I want to go back to the Jewish. It's interesting what you're saying about, because I guess this idea of the scene and the people, and there, I guess what I think maybe it's just occurring to me, the sort of common thing is this idea of belonging. That I think we're both very interested in where does a person belong.
Right.
And it's interesting because those kind of Jewish writers were very important to me as a Jewish writer, but also feeling like as a half Jewish writer, so therefore also kind of it always in and out. And that was how you know how I grew up. And I think I was very concerned, much more I think at the beginning of my career, about defining myself both as a Jewish writer and against being a Jewish writer, and trying to find ways of kind of creating half Jewish writing. And I think it's interesting to think that it wasn't a question of identity, maybe it was about belonging, which I think is
it's more
interesting
about belonging. It's so, like I was reading this fantastic collection of black sci-fi published exactly in the year 2000, which I think is the year we published or around then. And it's really like Afrofuturism, really incredible early example of that. And at the end of all the stories, there's an essay by Samuel Delaney, who's a great queer black sci-fi writer. And it's a really angry essay. He's making this argument, like, whenever I go to a sci-fi conference, they always put me with Octavia Butler. And I'm reading this in 2023, like, wait, what? And watching the way that those arguments flip, like, for him, it's an argument of, what's wrong with you white people? Everywhere I go, you always put me with Octavia Butler. We have completely different imaginations. Why are you always putting me together? 23 years later, this opposite argument would be made, right? So it's not that one argument is right and one argument is wrong. To me, that's not what interests me. It's just that these intellectual repetitions and fashions change so often. Mm. And you have to have some years on you to notice the patterns in which they move. So I felt from the beginning that belonging. I mean, maybe the one thing we had in common when we were young is the sense of the comedy about the border where belonging happens, that you're both, as a Jewish person and a black person, defined by your collectivity, but your collectivity is also your oppression. So a really dumb version is, you know, dancing. Like, I remember being a kid. When I was a kid, everyone would say, you know, black people love to dance. And I'd be like, don't tell me black people love to dance. And I'd be like, I love to dance. Like, I love to dance. So that was one of those strange borderlines where you are aware that the collectivity is both in some way true or sentimentally true to you, and also the definition of the thing you are categorized as. And it's annoying, but it's also absurd. It's an absurdity.
Yeah. And it's a form of policing as well. So the larger collectivity then tells you off if you're not perceived to be doing the kind of thing that the collective wants. This thing about kind of, because I think the idea of aging is also, I think, behind actually why certainly I was quite drawn to writing about history, was because I think I wanted to write about what time does, or my experience of time and what it takes away or reveals. And I think, I'm kind of interested, I don't actually have an answer for what I didn't want to do was write about, as it were, 1970 to 2023, that for some reason in Britain, so for some reason that was too close or too difficult. And so I think that it's not the only reason, but I think it was the idea of trying to find another space in which to kind of put time as the subject.
Well, I read it as you trying to get to the root of it. Like, there's a line, I've been noting down lines of yours all day. But there's one about, well, first of all, the book begins with, it all began with writing. But there's a sense that it's trying to find the moment when the world becomes covered in language, because it seems so normal and self-evident to us that the world is a linguistic object. So it's just represented all the time by images, words, secondary things. But it was not always the case. And you're getting a little bit earlier in that history where people are becoming quite self-conscious about the idea that there are, for example, second selves in the world. Like, so Adam's book is full of pamphlets, people writing about other people, gossip, basically. Gossip that's moving through the world and creating another you. But, you know, you don't have to go too much further back from where your book is set to find gazillions of people who would have seen no image of their own face, who could not have afforded a mirror, who might have seen themselves in a puddle, but had no conception of a secondary self moving through, or even existing, moving through the world. And I think that's been a preoccupation. Like, when I wrote Swing Time, I was thinking about, like, the internet had a beginning, and before that there were phones, and before that, you know, I was trying to think myself back into the ways I thought about time. And then going back this far, time works completely differently. Like, swing time is full of people really believing their lives can be, you know, fast-forwarded or the metaphor is a video, basically. Pause it at the moment where something really is going to happen to you. The media, the technology affects your way of viewing the world. So for me, reading your novel is like, oh, this is how people conceive of their social world when the printing press explodes.
Yeah.
When for the first time it's suddenly like, it's not just me, I'm not just here as a physical person on a chair, I can be in Paris in letter form or in Berlin or across town as a piece of gossip. It's so hard to get your mind back into how insane that must have felt.
Yeah, I think for me, like, there was a long time when, luckily, I didn't call it this. I wanted to call it Spooky Action at a Distance.
I do like that,
which
too.
Which I do quite like. Where I got more and more interested in, like, both how language in that era was, it felt like for the first time, was letting people exist in different places, as it were, in more than one location at once. So they're having this weird experience of teletransportation or something just by being written about or talked about.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, it's the era of colonialism.
Right, where, so it's being used to hide
so it's
things.
Exactly, and it's being used to be predatory, but while denying that you're being predatory because no one actually knows. And I think that was the other thing, you see, for you, because I think what's interesting in the fraud is partly how much, if I'm upset by messaging and pamphlets, it feels like you're actually obsessed by the novel as a genre almost, as a mass market genre, and as something that is suddenly proliferating. So Ainsworth is writing and is obsessed by sales figures. And
but novel is a weapon of oppression, which is a really hard thing to conceive of as a novelist, but there is just no doubt. I mean, both our novels, Adam's goes to Haiti, mine goes to Jamaica, and one of the things that is being represented by language is human bodies and human souls.
Yeah.
They're being represented in secondary terms as the slave or the savage or and circulated through European cities, but having no appearance, because particularly in the English context, which we've talked about a lot, everything is happening offshore. It's an offshore mentality right down to the bone. So that means everything's happening in language. There's no physical reality in front of you to know this is what this actually means. And so it's not that I hate novelists, but of course it's very hard to swallow watching a load of novelists sitting around discussing justice, rights, as we are right now, while sitting on top of monstrosity.
Yeah, well, that's what, because I think, are we in some way displacing, I mean, many monstrosities, like,
we're doing it right now.
Exactly.
We're having a literary event and we are absolutely sitting on top of monstrosity every moment. So that is something literature is always doing.
And is there a way, like, I'm just kind of thinking, how would you try and address, like, what's the direct way?
Well, the old argument was, if you render these secondary existences in language that is beautiful enough and humanising enough and has enough clarity, you will make these people real to other people, and then they will behave in a way.
But that's not true.
I don't think it is true.
Work.
It doesn't work. Yeah. It has a limited utility, and yet it is also not nothing. And I felt that that was important. Like, when I was writing this book, thinking about all the kinds of action, from, of course, at the most radical end, the slaves themselves revolting continually, or Toussaint Louverture in your book, to what we would call activists now, or labour rights heroes, people like Frederick Douglass, etc. But all those other people in the books, the kind of well-meaning abolitionists, the ladies refusing to take sugar in their tea, they are all being affected by language. And they are all doing something. And it is never sufficient, but it isn't nothing. And I feel it myself. Like, a few days ago, I was reading an account of where our fish comes from. Like, the fish you might be going to eat tonight, sushi, well, all your fish, basically, from what are basic, like, Chinese slaves on boats out in the middle of the ocean, sometimes for 2 years, being paid what I would call slave wages and being treated pretty much like indentured labourers. So this is not some kind of mysterious event that's it's happening now. And when I read something like that, of course, my life is not immediately transformed and I never eat another piece of fish again. I'm not that good a person, but I believe there are some people who do have that response. We both know young people who will never get on a plane again. God bless them all. So it does have an effect, the linguistic representation. It's just it's not guaranteed and it's not absolute. But to say it's nothing is a different kind of nihilism.
So do you think there's a way in which, I'm just thinking about kind of, as it were, us in 2000 with our kind of Nabokovian idea of that novels should be above, you know.
Painful to remember, yeah.
And where there, like, as it were, whatever was figured as wrong was figured purely as ironized
Aesthetic,
activity. And I think one thing that's true of both these books is that they're interested in guilt, which I think is a different, like, and the proliferation of guilt, which is, I think, what you're describing, is that if you construct societies that become world societies in many ways, what that will do is it will proliferate how much guilt each citizen...
You give a human being an impossible amount of guilt. Like, even mentioning the plane, I felt everyone in the room go, oh, planes. Yeah, I get on planes sometimes, yeah. So if the society is structured in such a way that there is no way in which to live cleanly, that is part... That seems to be partly a product of a kind of nihilism, because if you can't be perfect, why do anything, right? Yeah. Or if you can't be ideal, why act at all? So to me, the 19th century is like a lesson in half-good action and its utility, so that's something. But yes, you want a society in which such enormous structural issues are not the matter of individual morality. That's not what they should be the matter of at all. Individual morality is hard enough. Running your intimate life, your partner, your kids, your lovers, that's hard enough. The whole point of a decent, just structure is that it should...
You want to offshore your guilt.
You should offshore your guilt to the state in some form, who is hopefully a right actor. Yeah. But we're both writing books at times where the state is in no way a right actor. And yet people are still trying to live their intimate lives. And that's been in both of our books from the beginning.
Exactly.
What to do about your intimate life? Is there any point in it?
Because I think that in many ways, every book often reverses the book before or tries to get at whatever was revealed by the previous book. And certainly, I think in my book, the previous book, Lurid and Cute, which was about this terrible narrator who was basically just a sort of voice of privilege, having sex with whoever they wanted, doing whatever they wanted.
Right.
And with this knowledge that they were acting very badly, but that, you know, in the end, they didn't want to give up that kind of power. So I think in that novel, I was very interested in the sort of that double think that I feel the kind of person who reads a novel is thinking all the time.
Yes.
If you're in that privileged state. And so this, I think, was then an attempt to try and reverse the perspective in some way.
It would be the opposite of... complacency.
Or to find the genealogy of it, I think, which is what you're doing here as well, is to sort of find a genealogy for a certain way of thinking that you've been describing in the contemporary.
I mean, Nabokov is an interesting starter because he was in no way complacent, and his life had more political and personal struggle in it than most people's. But part of his resistance was pleasure. Which is such a weird concept now. Like, it's very hard to even read him, but he was so determined that his resistance would be, I believe in pleasure, I have a right to it, and neither the Nazis or the Gulag are going to take from me my belief in the beauty of the world and the pleasure of the world. And that was kind of enacted in this high aesthetic, which was perfect, and I think which attracted us both, but is also... I mean, I'd never read him now. I just find him airless. Like, I know it's beautiful, but I can't breathe in that, like,
do you think it's
perfect
also,
construction?
Like, yeah, so, you know, I certainly grew up reading much more than British novelists, reading Central European novelists.
Yeah,
you know,
much more. You are a breath of European air, thank God.
And I think one of the things that has shifted for me is that I think I totally, therefore, acquired in Kundera, in Nabokov, in Danilo Kish, in Hrabal, this idea that in order to, you had to resist the political, because the political for all of them was the totalitarian.
Right.
And therefore pleasure, as it were, the pleasure of the text or the pleasure of the refusal of politics. And then it took me 20 years to realize that obviously there's a very big difference if you've gone through those systems.
Right.
I feel like Kundera and Nabokov earn, if they want to posit pleasure instead of politics, then their suffering is the kind of...
Absolutely.
Reason for that, and it's not necessarily true that the bourgeois person from a suburb in London can claim the same apolitical stance. And so I think that...
The earth moves under you as you get older, both aesthetically, politically, culturally, but some of it's really interesting. Like, again, I remember thinking, it's kind of similar, that I wanted to reclaim the English novel for my people, to put my people in it, to write it in my way. But the older I got, some of the deep structures of the English novel are the problem. Like the coziness, the fact that everything always fits together in a lovely way. I read someone recently writing about my novel saying, it's so annoying, this novel, it resists you at every turn. I was like, yeah, that is exactly the fucking point. Because I've read all those other... I love Dickens, I grew up on that stuff, but it sends you to sleep in some way. It's like a lovely blanket that comes around you. It's incredibly enjoyable. But the point is not to think. He's saying to you, I'll do the heavy lifting. You have a good time. I'm here to give you a good time. And I think for both of us, the novel has been about thinking. Like, it's a way of thinking with language. And that is absolutely not to everybody's taste. I totally get that. Because there are other ways to think. You can think in an essay. You can think in an argument. And thinking in a novel seems an extremely perverse place to think. You could do it so much easier in a different form.
Well, no, you see, I think...
give people more pleasure.
I think the thinking of a novel, more and more, seems to be very related to the thinking of a friendship or a conversation. It seems related to the thing I love about conversations is the way they produce these things that you hadn't, neither of you had thought of and that there's something very beautiful. And that feels like going back to the way we were trying to describe the construction of a novel, of this thing produces something.
Yes.
And it doesn't know. You couldn't have produced if you were thinking only in terms of an essay.
And all those things that novelists sit on stages like this and waffle about, like, you know, I didn't know where the novel was going, and the novel tells me what it's about. And it's, you want to close it. But it's true. At some fundamental level, they're saying it's because it's true, though they romanticize it. But the novel does think in its own way. And when I'm writing an essay, and when I'm reading your essays, we're trying to make a case. It's an argument of some kind. And the whole point is to be a clever little kid and ace the argument, you know, and convince the person. But a novel, I know there are instincts I have. Like, I know this novel in some way is a revenge novel. I can feel it. Like, it's meant to be cozy and nice and until it really isn't. And I really wanted some kind of revenge. And I know that instinct. But it's still more diffuse as you write it. You know, you begin thinking, I want to show people what happened in this country. I want them to know. But you can't control people's reactions. And I've met readers who literally have sat and spoke to me for an hour about how my book is about lovely English writers having tea. And I'm like, oh, okay. So people move the way through a novel the way they want to move, right? You can't control them the same way.
And I think I had an anxiety about that when I started, like the anxiety of the reader and what they could do.
Yeah.
But
that's the thrilling bit. It's the freedom. When you're opening, you're not being told what to think. Not exactly.
Because it also seems to me that the difference between an essay and a novel is that with the novels, nothing. It's like it keeps carrying on in some way, so that there isn't a necessary endpoint to the sort of machine or network of the way a novel works. Whereas I feel like an essay, however brilliant in its insights or language, it stops and it's kind of. Like, I find the idea of rereading essays much harder to contemplate than...
Yeah, I don't see the point, yeah.
You know, once you've read an essay, you
unless
might...
Unless I've forgotten the argument and I want
to... It's also true.
Or unless you want to just make yourself feel smart for a minute again.
Or enjoy the beauty of an argument, but it is still linear and it's not going to... Whereas I think there's something about novels and the reason why rereading is clearly built into a novel, I think. Like,
well, now there's a question. I've been thinking about this. Like, it's built into our idea of a novel... Rereading those goddamn...
Big novels.
Yeah, over and over and over again. But is it really anybody's idea of a good time anymore, reading a novel more than once? And so that doesn't seem to me like a small question. Because you write novels with the idea that they need to be read more than once, which is a scandal in the present culture...
I think there's something different. I'm not saying that they're I'm more saying that they will respond to rereading and they can still be enjoyed. I mean, like, do you think TV shows are made to be rewatched?
Yes, you need a good 10 years in between and then it's a new show, like a good TV show.
So, yeah.
I love to do that, in fact. But I do sometimes think that our conception of a novel is, you know, disappearing. But at the same time, in a quite Thirlwellian move, I don't mind that much. I'm like, if it dies, it dies. Shit dies. I mean, it happens. Forms come, they go.
The epic poem is not.
Yeah,
really,
yeah. It's just one really of those things.
Anymore.
But I think the pleasure here in reading you and us writing these books at the same time is remembering. It's like one of those N+1 titles. What was the novel?
What was the novel?
Well, what was our kind of novel? And it was this kind
thing. To be more hopeful.
Yes.
I think what's interesting about both is that they seem to me to be different for ourselves. different to, like, I think one of the things that why we wanted to have this conversation.
Well done, we've grown up a little bit. Yeah. That was my main reaction. It only took 20 years, but some slight maturation. And that is exciting, because then maybe in your 50s and 60s, you have that technical skill and maybe something left to do.
Yeah. I mean, do you think the idea of being old, because I feel like I used to find it quite funny. You'd often describe yourself as middle-aged, even when we were about 25.
I started very early, yeah. I like to get ahead of the game, like in my own mind. I think, this is where it's happening.
I think I was much more anxious to keep describing myself as incredibly young until it became obvious that that was no longer plausible. And but I think that the sort of idea of, the like, would it matter if it was out of fashion? Like, why would that be a problem?
I just keep feeling recently this like radical freedom when I'm picking up the random book. Like at the moment I'm reading Wolf's Diaries, but any book out of time that just I grab off the shelf. It's the privacy, which you talk about so beautifully in this book, that privacy matters, and the relationship between you and a book that isn't of the moment or in the moment is radically private. It feels like it's just you and the book. And all kinds of strange combinations are happening between your 2023 mind and whatever crazy thing you picked off the shelf. And I find that really energizing at the moment.
Well, also, because like talking, so the crazy thing I was just reading was Tolstoy's A Confession, which
I just read Turgenev. Look at us, like old people in front of the fire.
Where Tolstoy is basically describing a nervous breakdown where, right, at the height of being the greatest novelist who ever lived and have just published Anna Karenina, he basically is like, everything I've done is shit and right. I should. And then he writes this thing, and then writes kind of a series of pamphlets culminating in like, What is Art? Where he describes an idea of what art should be that I was thinking, 20 years ago, I would have thought this was utterly insane, because he's basically saying style is, who cares how well constructed Anna Karenina is?
I've begun to think that.
And all that matters is, are you basically confronted with God? And I was reading this thinking, I totally agree with it, that there's something about that freedom of thinking. It's not that I don't love beautiful sentences or prefer them to ugly sentences, but
they're not a god.
That's not the point.
And I think we did, like, as much like Martin Amis and that whole crowd that we grew up under, like, it was sometimes hard to explain, if I saw Martin, to explain to him why a contemporary novel I just read was really great, because he couldn't, if the sentence didn't have that level of aesthetic density, it was illegible to him. He just couldn't understand what it was. So all kinds of writing just passed him by because it didn't have that.
Yeah.
And I love Martin, but I really didn't want that to happen to me. And so part of the exercise of it is just reading new all the time, different kinds of sentences, sometimes brutal sentences. They're brutal for a reason often when they're brutal. They're trying to do something to you which is of a different nature. Yeah. So trying to keep engaged at that level too is important. Have we talked for 45 minutes? Probably. I've got no watch. Someone else is going to take control of this matter.
We've got five more.
Oh, okay. So I want that. I want to be engaged at the level of sentence, to recognise that there are many, many, many ways to skin a cat.
Yeah.
And the classic kind of English sentence is just one of many.
I mean, because the other old-fashioned thing I think that both of us are clearly interested in have been for is this idea of the universal, which I think is a word that no one cool uses, but that is there in, I think, the way we think about the novel, because I think it's about if identity is multiple and each human has competing identities, right, so it can't be reduced to just one, then the way in which, like, there's a beautiful thing actually that I loved towards the end of your book where Mrs. Touchett, like, says, my people. You know, where Bogle says my, and she knows what he means.
Right.
And this idea of two very separate and different people having a commonality in the idea of what a people could be.
Right. I think sometimes it's just about defending that our commonality. Like, I have many overlapping peoples, like most people do, but one of the most significant is writers. They are my people. And quite often in the past, like 20 years, I felt that commonality is hard to express. But particularly when I went to America and was reading like a lot of American writing and writing I hadn't read since I was a kid, like a lot of Toni Morrison again, and like, we're part of the same diaspora, but everything about our individual lives is so different. But the possibility of communication between minds is what literature shows you over and over and over again. Not as some kind of idealistic, oh, we're all the same on the inside, whatever, but of a genuine attempt to make some kind of analogy.
Yeah.
Like Toni Morrison in Ohio in her mixed-race town is not me in Willesden in my mixed-race suburb, but there are analogies. I can hear them, I can feel them. And where we don't chime, that's not the point where I turn away like, oh, well, you don't get me or I don't get you. What kind of a way is that to have a relationship with a writer or a human? It's got to be this constant analogous dance.
Yeah, I wonder if... It's interesting, like one book we talked about earlier in the year was Daryl Pinkney's memoir of Elizabeth Hardwick.
Yeah, I love
which
that book.
I
and Daryl's a dedicatee of this book, yeah.
It's true. Which moved me so much because it's partly, for many reasons, but one of them was the just fervour with which he describes the
He's
writing
a believer.
Of pieces and the
So we should maybe say that Daryl Pinkney is a African-American scholar of, I would say, a diaspora. So, like, every detail of the diaspora is of concern to Daryl. He knows everything, every moment of history. But he is also a believer in literature in a way that when we're sitting around the table with Daryl, I'm embarrassed. I'm like, Daryl, you can't say things like that about literature, like it's an actual godlike activity. That's how he thinks about it. So he's 20 years older than us, I guess. He's in his early 70s. And that book is about him coming as a basically like a downtown heroin addicted student to Elizabeth Hardwick, who was teaching literature at the time, and being kind of kept by her, you know, like she looked after him, she looked after a lot of people, but their conversations are just books. Mm. Every day is books.
But I think it's also the nobility almost of, it is a good thing to read another writer and try and write about them.
Yes.
Honestly and sincere.
And she insists that he do it no matter what he's writing about, and he takes it on as a practice.
But I think it goes to that. I think it overlaps with what you're saying about whatever we do believe, something is to do with just the... I don't know what the right word is. I was about to say the sanctity, and I wouldn't want to use that kind of religious word, but like kind of something genuinely important in the act of trying to understand another human
And I've got less
language.
Shy. Like for the first time this year, instead of hiding my books in the house so I didn't see them, I've just made a pile, just an individual pile of each was just by my desk. I can see them, so that I wrote those books, and that's what I did. And I feel less like, and I even used the word vocation in an essay, because I think it is a kind of vocation, in that you do it every day. It means more to you than anything else, and you believe it. You have to believe in it, otherwise it's incredibly hard to do. But the nature of that belief, I don't really have a.
Well, I think it's strange because these books are so full. I mean, but is the hatred of writing or of language, maybe that's just the flip side of the devotion to it. Like, I think that...
I'm devoted to it, but I hate highfalutin language about it, though I suppose we've done that tonight. I hate writers' scarves. I hate writers' festivals. I hate the whole thing that goes on around it.
I don't.
Some do, some do. And just the sense of it as a kind of... such a rarefied thing that you don't have to do anything else practical in your life. Or that part always kind of repelled me. And also the idea that language will magically bring justice. And there was a lot of that when we were coming up in the 90s of, like, you know, the sacredness of the imagination. And if we could only just imagine, people would be freer. And so you got a little sick of that, listening to that.
Yeah. Well, I think that generally, I mean, I think because there had been... Certainly, say in century, you know, like there had been.
Well, there'd been Vaclav Havel. He had actually
Everyone
done it.
Everyone would point to Vaclav Havel,
right?
Even though he hadn't written a play for 30 years,
right?
But he was still. And I think though that model of that in some way writers could create a revolution was really important to the generation above us, the generation of our parents.
Yes, and we inherited in complete complacency the world that had been revolutionised supposedly. Yeah. So we were like, oh, can we just go to parties? Turned out that was an error. Yeah.
It's always an error.
Never
leave the house.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's that. From complacency to engagement. Well, we're done now. You can ask questions. Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi. This is a question for Zadie. Yeah. In your book, I love the description of London as it was then, particularly the Edgware Road, just sort of a country lane with fields surrounding it. After doing all your research, did you start seeing London in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, still it hasn't quite stopped. I mean, people said research, but it really, all you have to do in London is look above the chicken shop. That's it. It's all there. Nothing has changed. The 19th century is, I mean, particularly here, of course, but everywhere you go in Willesden, Kilburn, Kensal Rise, Halsden, it's not like it's gone anywhere. So the only stretch is remembering that until really recently, like 1889, that whole bit from top of Kilburn High Road to Marble Arch was pasture. And there was, just where Kilburn's overground station is, this beautiful place for taking the waters. So it was like a mini heath, but down the hill. And the railway station just destroyed all of that. And so I do still see it. But that was also part of the resistance of the book, that I really felt that it sounds so counterintuitive, but that the past was a place of resistance. When you're living in a technological reality, part of which capitalist agenda is that there is only the present. That's part of the point of the phone, of the way it moves, of the logic of the algorithm, is that now, don't look behind you. It needs you like that. And one of its crimes is that it's convinced the whole generation that there's nothing in the past worth using. So again, part of the argument was, yes, this was Fields recently, but it was also, you know, political movements of great solidarity across classes. Like, do you want to know about any of this stuff? Because it seems like useful political lesson for right now.
I was wondering, it's a question for both of you about historical novels. I was wondering if sort of what the relationship was to research, if there were ever any things that you uncovered that you wanted to change to suit the story you were telling, or any things that you decided you couldn't change because you wanted to be constrained by that sort of historical setting and context.
You go.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, yeah, I was very allergic as well to the idea that I had to do research.
I know, never had to do any proper work before.
Never had to do that before. And then there is definitely, I think, what I found was the fear of both under-researching and then over-researching, so that you would find out, because at a certain point you start to find so many amazing details. So, for instance, one thing is that actually there was a huge amount of characters I cut because... there was Edmund Burke and Edward Gibbon was coming in for little bit parts, and like, and for instance, talking of this kind of idea of speaking, there was another trial. So I'm glad I didn't do a trial, because then we'd have both had trials, where the trial of Warren Hastings, who was the governor of the East India Company, Edmund Burke and Sheridan. I love the idea that the lawyers were Burke and Sheridan, were trying to prosecute Warren Hastings, basically for mistreating, for managing a colonial enterprise. Which I found fascinating. And so I guess at a certain point you start to just think, well, I have to still have whatever is the story, so everything else will have to go. But I think it's interesting, this idea of, yeah, what you permit yourself to change. I also had this thing with real names, where I decided that some people would be allowed their real name. So Beaumarchais is in as Beaumarchais, and Napoleon is in as Napoleon. But then there are other people who were real, but where I gave them a slightly different name, or I gave them their first name that people might not know, and it was, I think, to permit some kind of freedom. And then also my central character, a woman called Celine, was both entirely invented but also based on a succession of real people. So I kind of, there was no one person who had her life story, but there were individual people who shared aspects of it.
I have a question. Is it true that women used to pee in bowls at parties?
Yeah, not in public, but yeah.
Just go around the corner into a...
Yeah.
Okay, that's in the book. I was just curious.
But do you... I mean, like, I remember... one of the things that I find fascinating about doing these kind of historical things, I have to say as if I've done it more than once, is the details that seem fantastical.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
And are true.
They're beyond fiction.
And that was quite interesting to me, I think, what it did to the sense of realism or not.
I had a problem with language around race. For instance, in the newspaper about Bogle, the Times always called him the man of colour. Everybody I gave it to said, why are you using a phrase from 2023 to describe this man in 1876? Yeah. I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Yeah. That is the phrase that was used in the Times to describe this man in the witness book. So it's stuff like that, that people think they know the past very well, yeah, and then they're continually surprised, and it seems anachronistic, but actually it's the truth. Yeah. So I had to make decisions sometimes. That one I left in because it amused me so much, but there was a lot like that,
yeah,
where things seem too contemporary to be true, but are true, yeah.
Your novel, the content was just amazing, really inspiring, everything. Well, I was just wondering about your structure. I've not read a book for ages with such a poetic, short, sharp chapters into little volumes. And I was just wondering why you structured it that way rather than doing these chunky chapters that so many authors.
I think that's a little bit about what I mean about reading new things. I'd seen it in other people's books. I like the epigraph. I like the idea of it. And I was trying to fight so hard against, I don't know what the word for it is, like continuity, that thing the English novel does, which is like kind of cozy you along so you don't really notice the gaps or the problems, or like the question that I think has become very current, like a question like, where does the money from Darcy's house come from? Well, you never think about it in Pride and Prejudice because you're too busy in the lovely, beautiful, perfectly knitted structure. But I didn't want that. You know, there are millions of those novels, and it's not that I can't write in a straight line. I can, but I really didn't want to.
You do something similar in NW now.
Yeah, I think part of it, like if I had my critic hat on rather than writer hat in, I think it's psychological. I think when you come from maybe a minority group and you're aware constantly of a secondary self that people see, so they think they know something about you. That's literally what prejudice means. So then you have to kind of write around it. And I realised that over the years, I've become very used to like Muhammad Ali, ducking and diving, basically, to get round this other thing, which is sitting in the middle of every text. And I think almost everybody, women have that feeling, Jews have that feeling. Anybody who isn't absolutely at the centre knows that there's a secondary self that's wandering around. And so that's what it is, I think. If I write in a straight line, it would to be assuming that everybody reading it knows exactly what I'm talking about, and we all come from the same place and have the same. That's how you can write in a straight line. Otherwise, you have to kind of maneuver a little bit.
I just wanted to ask you why or how you came to choose William Harrison Ainsworth as your subject.
I mean, like all things, he's just my neighbour. He's local, and I like local things. That was it, really. I just knew about him. Two facts made me laugh about him. One, that Shoot Up Hill in Cricklewood is called that, and people in Cricklewood will tell you it's because there were highwaymen in Cricklewood, but that's not true. It's called that because William set novels there and the truth got confused. So I thought, that's weird that you could write a novel and actually get a street renamed by accident. And also this funny fact about him, that he was so incredibly successful, so untalented, and so completely forgotten. I just thought that was a fantastic combination of human traits.
And then what about the trial? Like...
The trial came from a Borges story I read in college. The Tom Castro story, which is the trial, and he mentions Bogle. He gets his first name wrong, but he had the same idea. Borges said, that black man must have been a genius to speak for 2 years in court and tell this insane story and have the whole of England listen to him and believe him. So I read that story and thought, oh, I wondered about Bogle, because in Jamaica we have this hero, Paul Bogle. Were they related? I don't think they were. But it's just stuck in my mind, for 20 years, basically.
Hi. You've spoken about the 90s quite a lot. And
yes.
There's this weird thing at the moment. I keep this, like, back, this aesthetic, 90s aesthetic, yes, back. But this cultural sensibility is so, so, like, different. There's so much just, yeah, it's so different. And I was wondering what beginning to write a novel in that specific period, right at the end of the 90s, in that kind of... how things were then, what do you think it gave you? Yeah.
don't you notice, I really notice now, when we were young and the generation above us would talk about the 60s and you'd literally fucking roll your eyes like, shut up, talking about the fucking 60s and your love and you had love and whatever. You didn't want to hear a word of it.
We didn't have
it. It made you physically sick. And yet secretly you were kind of curious and you listened to the music and you read the books and you just didn't want to hear anyone with a ponytail tell you about whatever, true free love in Woodstock. And I think it's something similar, like my daughter would rather die than hear a single story of, oh, in the 90s we did this and that. And but there is this curiosity. I think the bit I can't deal with is the patronising fake memory of the 90s. So particularly in the case of women's issues, there's a lot of books and articles about, my God, do you remember the magazines with the, you know, like, and women must have been so unhappy then. And I'm like, have you been to a girls' school recently? Have you seen any 14-year-old girls? Are they running around in a state of unbelievable joy and happiness? Does anyone have a 14-year-old girl here? Might have a sense that new demons appear. And it just seems amazing. You can write these pious books about, you know, lad mags and then create a culture where every 10-year-old boy has Pornhub on his phone and is showing it to girls in the playground. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's absolutely extraordinary. So that part, that kind of like, oh, we know so much better now, I find a little bit intolerable, to be honest, because girls seem, if not more miserable than they were. In my, when I was, I don't know about you, when I was a kid in school, maybe two or three anorexics in a school of 2000. Yeah. How about now? Plus self-harm, plus. So I find that bit a bit like, ugh. 90s were bad, sure, but every era finds its own horror for women, apparently.
Don't you think, though, the strangeness of any era as well is that you're not aware, while you're in it, you're
it's not aware, nothing.
So that I
the
think
joke about
something...
90s, it was the most boring, nothing. Yeah. We used to laugh about, what is this we're living in?
We had
it's
no
literally
era.
Nothing. Yeah. Every other era has been something, this is just nothing. And now suddenly it's something, and we're too old to enjoy
but
it.
But I think the...
Ridiculous.
Everything. I feel like everyone was talking about the ironic and the cynical and the self-referential and the sort of, that was the sort of late 90s vibe. But I don't think I felt that.
No, I didn't feel that.
And I don't know how much...
It's constructed after the fact.
Yeah.
And I think even listening to those 60s boys, you could see they were also constructing it after the fact. In reality, they had jobs and lives and it was difficult. And it was only in the 80s that it was suddenly, you know, look at us on what we used to do. We were here, we were there. I think it's just something you construct and it becomes a nostalgia. Watching people like... I watched Take That interviewed on TV yesterday as if they were the Beatles. Like, are you... Are you serious? Like, bands you wouldn't have spat on in the street are suddenly, like, icons of music. So this is what happens.
And everyone's watching Friends.
Yeah, it's just what happens. It's no one watched Friends. Did you ever watch Friends?
No one watched Friends.
Never. Yeah. Not in your life would you have been seen watching that show. So it's just...
But you watch Friends now.
Now I watch it. Now I'm totally into it. It makes no sense,
Hi, thank you so much. I was really interested, Zadie, in what you said about the excess of the signifier. And Adam, you mentioned realism just before. And I guess I'm wondering about the question of realism and how it pertains to both of your practices. Right. And also what you might think about the necessity of or relevance of realism as a mode in the contemporary moment. Is it still relevant? And if it is, how can it be used? Thank you.
I think the new realism is, to me, a little bit gullible in front of the real. Like, it really takes reality as a solid thing that can be known and named and defined, and then it goes from there. And I do find that a bit strange and a bit alienating. That's not my idea of realism. My idea of realism was Ulysses. And like the question is, how does life really feel? That's Virginia Woolf's question too. Like, how does it really feel? Whereas I think a lot of writers now, if you're taking your cues from reality, from like television sitcoms, movies, you take that deep structure and grammar and you put it in your novel and everybody's quipping and fun. Yeah, okay, but that's not real to me. That's the mastery of a...
Of a code.
Of a code, yeah, of a series of codes.
But I don't...
And that's not realism. So I see it everywhere, but it doesn't really... with some notable exceptions, like Sally Rooney is a really notable exception, that the question of, is this how things feel? Yes, that's how it feels. That's how sex feels. she really understands something about realism. But the thing of, like, me and Joe and Tara in Hoxton were walking down the street, everything is solid, this, every, there's no doubt anywhere. And that is not how reality feels to me.
Yeah, and I think that's something that, if we're talking about the night, like, I feel like that was very much... realism was uninteresting to me from the beginning, and I think still is uninteresting to me in many ways, because it felt like a code that I think...
Like a sitcom.
That everything that is fascinating to me is about the instability of whatever we're calling the real and the difficulty of defining that. And I think it's where I have a slight set feeling of old-fashioned in relation to the auto-fiction as well, where it feels, not in all, but often what upsets me there is not so much partly that it is often linked to a sort of realist code, but also that the sense of the self is seen as very stable.
So stable. And and encourages a reader to be entirely gullible in front of that self. Yeah. It's like, oh, this person says I, so this is them.
And also so that this their is self-reporting authentic. Must be true.
Yeah.
Rather than...
But it's just a rhetoric. Doubtful. It's just a tone. It's a way of writing.
But I do think... I'm also very interested, though, in the idea of truth at the same time. So I think that there's some kind of distinction in my head. I mean, I think a lot of times when writers are talking, there's like they come up with two definitions, and they just mean this is the stuff I like.
Right.
And there's
and part of it's aesthetic.
And part of it, but there's kind of, it's very different. But I definitely would differentiate between what everyone calling truthfulness and realism, as it were. And I can see that for many people, like their real would also be true for them. But like kind of. I'm trying to think of a moment, like, I don't know, like where in Proust, where the grandmother dies or something, like a moment where the symbols disappear in some way. And I think that, ironically, I think that's often hugely to do with construction, so that there is actually a huge amount of codified work going on to produce these moments where, I don't know, I find it very difficult to find, but I think that's often what I'm reading for.
Well, you had the dream. I think I have a line here. This is a common dream. To say farewell to writing, to let all the objects stand there very simply and naturally as themselves, the way a fern or a mushroom might stand there. And that has long been the dream. Like, no metaphors, no flowery language, just the thing itself appearing. And yet a lot of people who are supposedly writing the thing itself, I get annoyed by. So I don't know what
I think
want.
They're not writing the thing itself.
No, they say they are.
So they say that. I think the state. Yeah, I think I would be. I'm always very distrustful of someone who thinks that they're a realist. It would make me worried that they're a bad person.
Thank you all very much for your questions and contributions, and for squeezing in. It's been wonderful. Thank you both so much. Honestly, it's been a real pleasure. I think some of the best events here are when we have two friends who, you know their stuff inside out, just really getting into it. So thank you both for bringing that here tonight and letting us all listen. Everyone, Zadie Smith and Nazim Farewell.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.